MyAudiobooks.ai presents The Memo That Proposed Murdering Americans, Operation Northwoods. Read carefully. In the spring of 1962, the highest military body in the United States put its signature on a document proposing that the government of the United States murder its own citizens in American cities and blame it on Cuba. Not a novelist's United States, not a thriller writer's Pentagon, the actual Joint Chiefs of Staff, in an actual memorandum, addressed to the Secretary of Defense, in the bureaucratic language of options and pretexts. The document is called Operation Northwoods, and it exists. You can read it today, declassified, on the website of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, scanned page by scanned page, complete with the routing stamps of the offices it passed through. It is the closest thing the American Republic has to a signed confession of what its national security apparatus was willing to consider at the height of the Cold War. And it was never executed, never approved, and buried so thoroughly that it took 39 years and an assassination records law to drag it into the light. The context matters, because without it, the document reads as pure madness, and with it, the document reads as something worse. Logic. It is 1962. Fidel Castro has held Cuba for 3 years and is tilting visibly toward the Soviet Union. The Bay of Pigs invasion has failed humiliatingly 11 months earlier. The CIA is running Operation Mongoose, a program of sabotage and assassination attempts against Castro personally. The Joint Chiefs are under presidential pressure to produce military options for removing the Cuban government. And the chronic problem is the pretext. An American invasion of Cuba without provocation would be, in the eyes of the world and much of America, simply aggression. The Northwoods Memorandum, prepared by the Joint Chiefs Staff and forwarded by Chairman Lyman Lemnitzer to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara in March of that year, was the staff's answer to the pretext problem. Its formal title is bloodless: Justification for U.S. Military Intervention in Cuba. Its content is a menu of manufactured justifications, and the word the memo itself uses, without embarrassment, is pretext. The menu is the part that still has the power to stop a reader cold, and it should be read with care, because the document's own words are the entire story. The proposals range from the theatrical to the homicidal. Stage an attack on the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba, with the memo helpfully noting the precedent. Remember the Maine, the battleship whose explosion in Havana Harbor in 1898 handed America its war with Spain. Sink a boatload of Cuban refugees, real people, on the high seas, or simulate the sinking and blame the Cuban military. Develop what the memo calls a Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and in Washington. Bombings, the document specifies, with casualty lists prepared in advance for the funerals. The memo weighs whether to use real casualties or simulated ones at various points, discussing the matter in the tone of a logistics annex. And it proposes manufacturing a Cuban Air Force, building mock Soviet Cuban MiG fighters, or repainting American aircraft in Cuban markings and using them to harass civil aircraft, so that when a civilian airliner was shot down, America would have its atrocity, complete with debris. It is also worth pausing on who wrote such a thing, because the answer is not villains, but professionals. The Joint Chiefs Staff in 1962 were the finest military planners of their generation, men who had planned the logistics of Normandy and the airlift to Berlin, educated in the staff colleges of two world wars, fluent in the grammar of contingency planning. Their profession has a rule: never tell the leadership it has no options. When a president asks for military options on Cuba, the staff produces options, and the pretext problem is simply the hardest variable in the equation they were handed. The Northwoods memo is what that profession produces at its outer limit. Not madness, but method. The method of men trained to solve the problem in front of them, who had perhaps forgotten that some problems are not meant to be solved. The document is most disturbing, not as an outburst of evil, but as a triumph of technique. There is a sentence in the memorandum that deserves to be read twice, because it is the sentence the entire document exists to serve. The goal, the staff wrote, is to place the United States in the apparent position of suffering defensible grievances from a rash and irresponsible government of Cuba, so that the world would see American military action as justified. Apparent position. The grievances were to be apparent, manufactured, so that the response could be real. This was not a rogue colonel's daydream found in a footlocker. It was the considered product of the professional staff of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reviewed, formatted, signed, and sent to the civilian leadership of the Department of Defense as a recommendation. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. What happened next is the part of the story that saves it from being only a horror. McNamara read the memorandum and was appalled. 3 days after it arrived on his desk, President Kennedy met with Lemnitzer and rejected the Northwoods proposals outright. The president told the chairman, in substance, that the United States was not going to invade Cuba. Full stop. Kennedy would later ease Lemnitzer out of the chairmanship. The memorandum went into the files and into silence. No operation was ever run. No terror campaign was ever conducted. No refugee boat was ever sunk. The document is a proposal that was refused by the civilian authority it was addressed to, and that refusal is as much a part of the historical record as the proposal. And then comes the irony that history appended 7 months later. In October of that same year, the world came closer to nuclear war than it has ever come, not over a manufactured pretext, but over a real one. Soviet missiles discovered in Cuba by an American spy plane. 13 days of brinkmanship, the naval quarantine, the letters between Kennedy and Khrushchev. The Joint Chiefs, the same body that had written Northwoods, recommended airstrikes and invasion during the missile crisis too, and the same president refused again, choosing blockade and negotiation instead. The sequence is the whole story in miniature. A military staff that kept reaching for the pretext and the escalation, and a civilian president who kept saying no, in March over the memo and in October over the missiles. Northwoods was not the moment the system nearly lied its way into war. The missile crisis was the moment it nearly fought its way in, honestly. The two refusals belong in the same file. How the document surfaced is its own parable about secrecy and sunlight. For 39 years, Northwoods existed only as rumor. The Kennedy administration's Cuba files were classified, and the memo slept in them. In 1992, after the film JFK convulsed the country's faith in its official history, Congress passed the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act, creating an independent review board with a simple mandate: open the records. The Assassination Records Review Board spent the 90s prying loose millions of pages, and among them, in the files of the Kennedy-era defense establishment, was the Northwoods Memorandum. In 2001, the author James Bamford published Body of Secrets, his history of the National Security Agency, and the Northwoods document appeared in it for the first time in public view. The National Security Archive posted the full document online, where it sits today, unredacted, for anyone to read. A word on how to read a document like this, because the skill transfers to everything else in the declassification record. The scanned memo carries the marks of its own life, the routing stamps showing which offices received it, the classification banners top and bottom of each page, the later review stamps from the declassification process, the formal mechanism by which secret documents are open to the public after review, page by page, by archivists with the legal authority to release them. Those markings are the difference between a document and a story about a document. A declassified paper with its stamps is evidence. Someone signed it, offices received it, the state archived it, and the law eventually freed it. The National Security Archives posted copy is the primary text. Anything that quotes it without the stamps is a retelling. Northwoods is unusually well documented. Multiple copies exist across collections, the provenance is clean, and no serious institution disputes its authenticity. That is exactly why it rewards slow reading. The strongest document in the conspiracy library is also the one most often quoted from secondhand. And here is where this article must do the hardest work any piece of writing about Operation Northwoods has to do. Because the document is the single most abused piece of paper in the conspiracy economy. In the 60 years since it was written, and the 25 since it surfaced, Northwoods has been cited as proof of nearly everything. Proof that 9/11 was an inside job. Proof that every American military action is staged. Proof that mass casualty events are false flags by default. The logic runs, they proposed it once, therefore, they do it always. That logic is lazy, and it is wrong. And it is wrong in a way that does a disservice to what the document actually proves. The concept the conspiracy economy is reaching for has a name, and the name has a history. The false flag, an operation conducted by a state while disguised as the work of its enemy. False flags are real in the historical record. The Gliwice radio station incident that Nazi Germany staged to justify invading Poland is the canonical case, which is precisely why the term must be handled with discipline. A real concept with real precedents becomes useless the moment it is applied as a default explanation for everything unexplained. What the memo was manufacturing has its own formal name in the laws of war, a casus belli. The cause that justifies war, the grievance a state presents to the world and to itself as the reason its armies may cross a border. The Northwoods staff understood that America lacked one for Cuba, and their memorandum is, at bottom, a proposal to build one from spare parts. The memo proves the concept was proposed at the highest level of the American military. It does not prove the concept was ever executed. And the burden of proving execution, for this event or any other, belongs to whoever claims it, document by document. Northwoods is not evidence that the United States stages attacks on itself. It is evidence that the most senior military staff in America once formally proposed staging attacks, and that the civilian leadership of the American government rejected the proposal within days and sidelined the man who signed it. The document does not prove the system is a conspiracy. It proves the system had a boundary, and that in 1962, the boundary held. But the honest reading has to go one step further, because the boundary is not the whole lesson either. The Northwoods Memorandum is not an aberration that appeared from nowhere. It is a document from a system. The same years produced Operation Mongoose, the actual approved campaign of sabotage and assassination attempts against Castro. Real operations, not memos, with real explosives and real poison. The same years produced the CIA's partnership with organized crime for Castro's assassination. Approved covert action at the highest levels. The same years produced a 1,000-page record of approved deceptions. Disinformation, staged defections, fabricated evidence, as routine tools of statecraft. The doctrine that governed their paperwork had a name, plausible deniability, the practice of structuring an operation so that its sponsors can credibly deny knowing of it, with approvals routed through cutouts, language kept off the record, and presidents protected from ink. The CIA's Castro plots were built for it. The agency's own inspector general later wrote the internal history of how thoroughly the deniability was engineered and how little it helped when the stories came out anyway. Northwoods is the opposite kind of document. No cutouts, no deniability. A signed recommendation on official letterhead. The two papers together show the era's two faces. The covert system built to be disavowed, and the staff system willing to sign its name. Northwoods was exceptional in its candor about killing Americans, not in its comfort with deception. The question the document actually raises is not, does the government lie to its people? The declassified record answers that plainly. Yes, as a matter of documented policy. The question is where the line sits between deception that stays bureaucratic and deception that costs American lives. And Northwoods shows the line being located precisely at the president's desk in a single meeting by one man's refusal. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. The strongest case against the boundary reading, Northwoods as warning, not boundary marker, deserves a full hearing because it is the reading that history keeps vindicating in pieces. The system that rejected Northwoods is the same system that 2 years later reported an attack in the Gulf of Tonkin that did not happen as described and went to war on it. The same system that 40 years later presented weapons of mass destruction intelligence to the public with a certainty the intelligence did not possess and went to war on that. The pattern those critics draw is not that every event is staged. It is that the appetite for pretexts is a recurring feature of the national security state under pressure, that the only thing standing between a Northwoods memo and a Northwoods operation is the character of whoever sits at the president's desk on a given week, and that systems which depend on the character of individuals rather than the strength of institutions are systems that will eventually meet the wrong individual. On this reading, Kennedy's refusal is not the proof the system works. It is the proof of how thin the wall is. And the strongest case for the boundary reading is the document itself. The staff proposed, the civilians refused, the signer was removed, the memo was buried by the same classification system that later opened it under law, and the whole sequence is now public precisely because the system's own sunlight mechanisms, an act of Congress, an independent review board, a public archive, dragged it out. A conspiracy that careful does not pass the JFK Records Act. Three tests would disprove one reading or the other, and each is checkable against the continuing declassification record. First, the follow-on record. As the JFK and Vietnam-era collections finish opening, if documents emerge showing Northwoods-style proposals being seriously entertained at the presidential level in later administrations, rather than rejected as Kennedy rejected, the warning reading strengthens into a pattern. Second, the Tonkin and Iraq documentary records. If the full declassified files show pretexts being knowingly manufactured at the staff level in those cases, with the same candor as Northwoods, casualty lists and all, the boundary looks less like a wall and more like a fence with gaps. Third, the oversight record. If the congressional and inspector general files show the Northwoods memo generating any internal accountability at the time, any review, any reprimand, any institutional response beyond Lemnitzer's quiet transfer, then the system metabolized the lesson. If they show nothing, the lesson was never learned institutionally, only personally. It is worth saying what this article has not claimed. It has not claimed Operation Northwoods was executed. It was not, and no evidence has ever suggested it was. It has not claimed the Joint Chiefs were madmen. They were strategic planners working a defined problem under real geopolitical pressure. And the horror of the document is precisely that it is rational within its own frame. It has not claimed the American government stages attacks on its citizens. The document shows a proposal and its rejection, and this article has said so in plain terms. And it has not claimed the document is fake. It is authentic, declassified, archived, and uncontested by every serious institution that has examined it, which is exactly why it must be read with more care than it usually gets.
Which returns to the scanned pages sitting on a public server in Washington, with their routing stamps and their casualty lists and their talk of funerals. The most dangerous document in American history is not dangerous because it describes what the government did. It is dangerous because it describes what the government was asked to do, in writing, by the men at the top of its military. And because every reader who finds it must then decide what it means, that the answer was no. The optimists see the no. The pessimists see the ask.
The document sees nothing. It just sits there, declassified, patient, waiting for the next administration to be handed the same question under a different name. And the only thing that has ever stood between the memo and the world is the person who reads it next and has the power to say no again. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.